All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Optimizing SQL Server Performance in a Virtual Environment. So my name is Denny Cherry. I'm an independent consultant out of Southern California. My URL is right there, www.mrdenny.com. I've got my contact info and stuff on the next slide, so you can get a hold of me if you want to after the session. If you don't get my email address written down, feel free to come grab a business card. I've got a big old stack of them up here in case you want to grab them. So there's my email address, URL again, my Twitter handle. I'm on Twitter fairly regularly, with the exception of when I'm at these conferences and don't have my computer sitting in front of me most of the time. So I am a Microsoft MVP for the SQL Server product. I am a Microsoft Certified Master for SQL Server 2008. I am also a VMware vExpert for the year 2012. When I am out and about, I've written several books, write various magazine articles, both for SQL Server Magazine and for searchsqlserver.com, so you can find a lot of the material that I've written there. I've been working with SQL Server for about 15 years or so, so I've got a fairly deep understanding of a lot of the concepts within SQL Server, and we're going to talk about a lot of those today and how they relate specifically to when you have SQL Server installed in a virtual machine. So before we get started, quick show of hands, where are my DBAs at? Okay, about half the room. My database developers. Very, very small showing, so we're going to pummel you guys later. Where are my sysadmins at? Okay, good number. Anybody thinks that this is WWDC and thinks this is an iOS 6 presentation? Nobody? Nobody? Okay, cool. So you're all in the right state. That's a good sign. So I've broken this presentation down into basically four topics. Diagnosing performance problems within SQL Server and how that's specifically going to relate to working within a virtual machine. Balloon memory drivers and the memory drivers in general, memory settings in general, and how we want to configure those and some of the options we have available to us to try to get best performance. Then I want to look at some of the memory deduplication options that are going to be available in the hypervisor products. And then we're going to look at some of the storage configuration options and what are some of the options available to you when working a virtual machine so you can get the best possible performance out of the system. Now, unfortunately, I'm not going to be talking today about the brand new Azure offering of running your own virtual machine with SQL Server in it, because unfortunately they didn't tell me about it when I put this deck together and I didn't find out about it until like 3 days ago. And at that point, it's a little late to change the deck in the presentation and do any sort of in-depth research on it as I'm, you know, here in Florida with my family enjoying the weekend before coming and presenting. So if you have specific questions on that, shoot me an email. I will be doing research on that when I get back home after Tech Ed EMEA in 2 weeks. And I will be more than happy to do any research I can to help you figure out what it is that you are looking for to try to move your environment into the Azure app role, if that's where the direction that you decide you want to take your virtual machine environment. So when working with SQL Server in a virtual environment, and by the way, I'm going to be talking about both Hyper-V and the VMware vSphere product. So this is not just a Hyper-V talk or a VMware talk. I'll be dealing with both platforms as best I can with all these things I'm going to talk about. So the first thing you want to do whenever you do see a performance problem is obviously check the CPU numbers of the guest. Look at what the CPU is showing you in Task Manager, look at what it's showing you in Perfmon within the guest operating system. But don't stop there if you don't see any problems, because you may see performance-related problems within your virtual machine, even if your guest CPU performance numbers don't look like they have any problems. And that's because you've also got to look at the host as well. And by the host, I mean either the vSphere hypervisor server or the VMware Hyper-V server. Yeah, I got those correct. No, Microsoft Hyper-V server, sorry. It's been a long day. I had booth duty this morning. So check the numbers at the host as well, because you're going to need to correlate those numbers to the guest and make sure that you're getting the accurate picture and the whole picture. Because while you may see that the CPUs in the guest are working fine, maybe they're at 15, 20%, but you're still seeing performance problems on the box, And I'm talking about general performance problems at this point, not, you know, like one query is running slow, but, you know, everything's running slow. The UI is slow when your remote desktop in, stuff like that. You need to look at those host numbers at that point, because you may find that you have another virtual machine in the host environment spinning the CPUs out of control. Now, you can look at these host numbers in a few different ways. If you're in a Microsoft Hyper-V environment, you can actually run Hyper-V on the host server itself. And so you can do this either by logging into the host computer. Hey, I can actually see everybody if I stand on this side of the stage. You can log into the host computer itself and just bring up Perfmon just like you normally would if you've got the full UI installed on the host computer. And then you can simply navigate to the CPU performance counters and look at them for the individual VM processes that are running on the host. Or you can connect to a remote administration server and use Perfmon on that machine to remotely connect to your host computer and get access to all those Perfmon counters as well. Now, if you're in a Hyper-V environment, or sorry, a vSphere environment, we don't have Perfmon because this is not a Windows box that's running at the host level at this point. This is actually basically a Linux box that's running. So you need to use an application called VMware vCenter. This is going to be the management tool that your sysadmin team uses to monitor performance on the host environment and to configure and use and create VMs at the host level. So this application, it's a Windows-based app, so it's very easy to use and get logged into, because it will just use your Windows authentication to log into it. And it will actually let you see what the performance monitor counters are at the host level, so you can see what those host CPUs are doing. And it'll then let you drill into the host and see what VMs are doing what on that host to see which VM is actually taking up all the CPU power, or if there's multiple VMs taking up all the CPU power. Because you've got to remember, when you're working in this VM environment or in a virtualized environment, we are dealing with shared resources. So maybe we've got a server that's got, you know, a physical server that's got 16 cores available to it, maybe 2 8-core processors. Then we've got, say, 20 VMs that are all running on that box. Each of those VMs has maybe 2 or 4 virtual CPUs. We obviously don't have enough physical processor cores to have each VM have its own resources. So we have to do a lot of resource sharing. So if one VM is sending its processors up through the roof, we'll see performance problems with other processors. Now, the host platform is going to do its best to alleviate this by trying to move resources around within the host to try to reduce the impact of this one VM absolutely going nuts. So what it's going to do when it's doing that is it's actually going to move the VMs from one core that's busy to the cores that are more idle to try to balance the workload on that server. Unfortunately, when it's doing this, we've now got more and more VMs all running on these same processors. So we can now end up running into CPU thrashing problems because we don't have enough cores to handle just the available workloads that we have running. Because you've got all these different virtual machines all trying to do different things. If these are all SQL Server boxes, you know, every one of those virtual CPUs within each guest has a scheduler assigned to it. And those are all now trying to run against this one physical processor. And that one physical processor is just task switching like crazy, trying to handle all this workload that's available, or that's trying to be pushed to it. So you can actually see if this is happening relatively easily. It's actually a lot easier to do in a Windows environment than it is in a VMware environment. So in the Windows environment, if you're in a Microsoft Hyper-V environment, you can actually look at the system performance counter group, and within there, look at the processor queuing Perfmon counter. And that's going to give you a general idea of how much of a queue depth has been built up against the processors. And again, you're going to want to look at this at the host level, not the guest level, because the host may show this ridiculously large queue. Unfortunately, there's no easy way to solve for this, because, you know, without really moving virtual machines to other hosts or adding other hosts into your environment. Now, in the VMware environment, it's a little harder to get this Perfmon counter, because in VMware 5 or vSphere 5, we now have a kind of a headless server where we don't really have an operating system we can log into on the physical hardware anymore. But you can log onto the server's console and then from there get down to a Unix prompt and run an application called ESXTOP. It's ESXTOP. So show of hands, anybody from a Unix background? A few, okay. So you guys remember the top command in Unix? So basically, for those of you who aren't from a Unix background, what top does, it basically just shows you a list of processes that are running, how many resources they're consuming, and a bunch of various metrics about them. Kind of like Task Manager in Windows, kind of the same kind of information from that processes tab. So ESX top, very similar, but it's only going to show you the virtual machine information. And then it's going to show you some overall information about the server. So one of the pieces of overall information it's going to show you is percent used. And what that's giving you is called the percent ready time. And if that percent used value, and it's going to be in the upper right-hand corner of ESX, if that number's over about 70, 75, 80%, somewhere in that range, you know, if it's 100%, things are really bad. But if it's anywhere above about 70 to 80%, you're going to be seeing performance problems that you're going to need to resolve. And again, the only real way to resolve that's going to be to move those virtual machines from that physical box off to another physical server somewhere. So in either VMware or Hyper-V, you're going to either use Live Migration or vMotion to do that migration of the guest from one server to another. In VMware's environment, that's going to be a seamless operation, no downtime whatsoever. Currently in Hyper-V V2, which is what comes with Windows Server 2008 R2, there's going to be a very, very slight cutover time when the VM is basically paused on one machine and started on another. It's usually about half a second or a second. It's a real, real short operation, but you are going to see this little hiccup that's going to happen as the VM is moved, where no new client connections are going to come in and nothing's going to get processed during that period of time. As I understand it, Hyper-V version 3, which is going to be coming out with Windows Server 2012 when that releases later this year, is going to fix that problem, so that little ping of downtime is going to go away. So you're going to be able to live migrate from one physical box to another very, very quickly and easily. Another easy place that you can see performance problems where you may not necessarily see them in the guest operating system, but you may see them in the host operating system, is if you're having slow disk I/O time, or if you're seeing very, very random sporadic disk I/O problems. You may not see these problems necessarily at the guest level other than long I/O response time. So maybe you see a real low stream of I/O, maybe 15, 20, 30 I/O a second going to the disk, but you see a really high response time from those I/O requests when you look at the seconds per read and seconds per write perfmon counters. So if you are seeing those, the next place to look is going to be, again, back at the host level, because you want to see what the physical host is reporting for those disks as well, because it may be seeing high load numbers that you need to resolve, and maybe it's got a VM that's actually pinging a workload and destroying the workload over there. So I was working for a company a few years ago now. It's a physical environment, but the story kind of still applies. We were in a shared storage environment over at a managed hosting provider, and we were having all sorts of SQL Server performance problems one day. Just started up, no explanation, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which was a nice convenient time to start having performance problems that we couldn't diagnose. So I gave a call up to the hosting provider, talked to the first SAN admin, who had no idea what I was talking about and didn't understand what I was trying to say. And I got one gentleman over here nodding and laughing because apparently he's either heard this story or he's been through this before. got the first SAN guy on the phone, got rid of him. He didn't know what I was talking about because all he kept telling me was, I'm not seeing any I/O coming through your system. And I'm like, you're right, you're not. I can't push any I/O to your system because I'm getting response times of like 7 seconds. Not milliseconds, seconds. Obviously very, very bad for SQL Server. So I finally got to the third SAN engineer who actually had a brain. So I got him on the phone, and he was looking at my LUNs, and he's like, yeah, I'm not seeing a problem. Well, but did you buy more storage recently? Aha, a question. This is something the previous guys had not done before. He asked questions. So I said, well, as a matter of fact, yes, I've recently purchased another 100 gigs of your fantastic SAN storage. I may have been slightly snarky when I said that. He said, yes, I can see that, because I see that you have two fragments of your LUN, one by itself in a RAID group with nothing else in it, and one that's often a shared RAID group of our nice 1 terabyte LUN. I'm like, okay, well, we're supposed to have dedicated storage, so we're not supposed to be on a shared space. So is there anybody else in that shared space? As a matter of fact, there is. There's one other customer there with one LUN. Okay, can you log onto that server and tell me if it's a file server, please? I can tell you right now it's a file server based on the name of the server. Sweet, can you log onto that box for me and tell me if it's running a defrag operation right now? Well, he's obviously not supposed to do this, but he did it anyway because he thought this was kind of funny at this point. So he logged onto the box and said, as a matter of fact, yes, this is doing a defrag operation. Would you like me to move your LUN to another resource group, please? Yes, please. How long is that going to take? Because I need to give my boss some sort of ETA so that he can call the salesperson and yell at them in the morning about the length of the outage. So needless to say, this story correlates very nicely to working in a virtual environment. I was in this shared environment that I had no visibility to, and I had to simply guess at what my potential problems were based on the information I was getting from some other dude on the phone who was living 2,000 miles away from me. Hopefully your sysadmins are a little closer than that because it's kind of a pain to throw things at them when they're 2,000 miles away. I was able to work through this problem eventually, but it took a few phone calls and it took some time to get to this point. And it's the exact same thing when working in a virtual environment. You've got these multiple layers that you need to look at that you may or may not have access to. Now, I've said a couple of times now, simply just fire up the vCenter environment, or the vCenter management tool, or fire up Perfmon against the host, and you can look at these metrics, which technically is true, provided you have access to these resources. The sysadmins in the room may want to cover their ears right now, because I'm going to give everybody else in the room information you might not want them to have. In the VMware vCenter environment, there are permissions-based roles that can be granted so that you can actually log into vCenter without the ability to actually create another VM, without the ability to change virtual machines. This setting is very complex. It's very hard to find. It's called read-only. All they need to do is drop your domain group in or domain user account into that role, and you can now log into vCenter and have read access to this performance data so you can actually see what's going on. Fancy that, I know, very complex. Hyper-V is set up the exact same way. So if all you have is just a Hyper-V cluster, no SCVMM, no SCOM configuration, you can simply fire up Perfmon against those machines. There is a native Windows group that's called something along the lines of Performance Monitor Read Access or something to that effect. If they drop you into that group on the host, you can gather Perfmon stats against the host using Perfmon on your workstation or on your management server, however you get access to your data center machines. So you can go get this information and actually look at it and see what's going on. So this is not hard to get set up. It's just a matter of a lot of the times the sysadmins don't want to give up this information. So here's something else the sysadmins may want to cover their ears for. If you're in a VMware environment, the data that's shown in vCenter, anybody heard of Microsoft SQL Server? Because that's where the data, like six people put their hands up. Come on, guys. That's where the data for vCenter is stored. So if nothing else, getting access to a SQL Server database in your environment, I would imagine, is not very hard, especially if you are, I don't know the DBA. So you get access to that box and simply query the data out of the system itself. VMware's done a really good job of releasing publicly, without any sort of username or account required, access to the schema for the VMware database, for the vCenter database. I've actually got a couple of indexes posted on my blog about how to actually improve performance on that database, because there's a couple of missing indexes you need to create. So you can actually just query that database, throw it into Excel, throw it into Power View or something, and get some nice graphs out of it fairly easily to see really what's going on there. I can give you those queries. Shoot me an email. The question was, can you get those queries from me? Email me. I should probably just blog them at some point. So I will either email me and I will get them to you relatively quickly, as it'll be a while before I can blog them, but I will put a blog post together with them at some point and get that published, because that is a nice, easy way to get that info out of there. Now, if you're working in an environment with Hyper-V and you've got SCOM, S-C-O-M, and Microsoft Virtual Machine Manager to manage the Hyper-V environment, that information is also stored in a SQL Server database over on the SCOM server. So you can gather all those performance metrics out of there as well. And also, SCOM is permissions roles based. So your sysadmin team can give you rights to go look at that information and gather all the statistics that you do need. Next, there we go. So along with CPU performance problems and disk I/O problems, something we hear about quite often that's gotten earned itself a really, really bad reputation is the balloon memory driver. So this came out in VMware first, but we did become available as a feature of Hyper-V when the host is running Windows Server 2008 R2 or higher with SP1 applied. So what the balloon memory driver does is it basically, its job is to sit there, and in the event that the host operating system needs to get memory back for some reason, its job is to go get memory back from the guest operating system and release it so that the host can use it or make it available for the host to use. So you'll see an app running in your server, and you'll know when the balloon memory driver is doing something when this random application that you have no idea what is starts getting lots and lots of memory allocated to it. And it's going to be something like VM balloon or VM balloon driver or Hyper-V balloon driver, something along those lines. You'll know it when you see it, trust me. It'll be the thing with all the memory that you want your SQL Server to be using. So now, having the balloon memory driver up and running is not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of people out there that say, well, let's just disable the balloon memory driver because we don't ever want it running because it's never gonna do anything useful for me. And actually it is. You just don't realize it. So the balloon memory driver only does something when the host is out of memory. Under normal operating conditions, your host should never be out of memory. So under normal operating conditions, the balloon memory driver is just going to sit there and do nothing, and it's not going to eat up memory. The only time the balloon memory driver is going to kick in is when there's a problem, usually a pretty bad problem. Maybe you've had a host fail, and you now need to spin up a bunch of virtual machines on hosts they don't normally run on. This being the case, maybe you need to allocate more memory to the host to get some of these VMs back up and running or something along these lines. In those cases, the balloon memory driver is going to take that memory back and release it back to the host operating system so the host can do whatever it is that it needs to do. So this is actually a good thing, because if this doesn't happen, one of two things is going to happen. Whatever process the host is running is going to fail, and something's going to be down for a good long time. Or potentially worse than that, the host operating system is going to start paging out memory. And when it's going to be paging out memory, it's going to probably start with the VM that has the largest amount of memory, which is going to be one or more SQL servers. Where this starts getting into some serious problems is because SQL Server at this point doesn't know it's been paged out. So if the host now has paged what we think is memory to disk, that memory may contain, oh, say, buffer pool, things we access on a fairly regular basis. And as this is happening, SQL Server is trying to access what it thinks is memory, but that memory is actually sitting on disk, and we have no way of knowing that memory is on disk. All we know at this point is we've just simply gone from nanosecond response times, or sub-5 millisecond response times, to 20 or 30 millisecond response times as we're hitting local disk, because that's what we've been paged out to. So suddenly we've got these memory ranges in our buffer pool or in our plan cache that are extremely slow. And SQL Server is not going to do anything about this. It's just going to wait for these memory accesses to happen. And we're going to see this very, very sporadic, very, very poor response time in SQL Server when this is happening. So because of that, I want to have that balloon memory driver turned on whenever it can, because we don't want to run the risk of the host operating system getting paged out. I'm okay with losing a little bit of memory from SQL Server in the event that something bad has happened to ensure that we don't have problems if something bad has happened, if we don't have major problems when something bad has happened. And the balloon memory driver is going to be how we're able to do that. So like I said, it should be enabled on all your virtual machines. It can be disabled on case-by-case basis if there's some very specific reason to do it. I know a lot of people get worried about having the balloon memory driver enabled, and there's really nothing to worry about it with under normal circumstances, because it's just going to sit there and do nothing, because it's just waiting for the host to say, hey, give me memory. There is a lot of misinformation out there about the balloon memory driver. One of the biggest things out there is how it's getting its memory back. And this, it applies to either the VMworld or the Hyper-V world. Because a lot of people think that it's just going to randomly start grabbing memory and allocating memory at a real low level and doing some real nasty things to try to get memory back. And it's actually not. What the balloon memory driver is going to do is it's simply going to request memory using the normal Windows API calls that every application uses. Same exact memory calls that SQL Server would use. It's going to simply say, hey, give me back memory. So Windows will then get this request give me memory. I want memory. I need memory for something. Windows is going to simply go, okay, well, let me go find you some memory. It's going to go to the SQL Server service, because that's going to be the biggest consumer of memory on the box, hopefully. And it's going to go, all right, I need memory back. Give me back, 512 megs of memory. Or, whatever memory amount the balloon memory driver's requested. So SQL is going to simply return the memory back to the operating system, just like it's supposed to. Hopefully it's going to return it fast enough that these requests aren't timing out from Windows. Once SQL Server gives that memory back to Windows, Windows is then simply going to give that memory to the balloon memory driver. Once the host operating system is done doing whatever it is that it needs to do, it's simply going to tell the balloon memory driver, all right, you can have this memory back. Give that memory back to your guest operating system. The balloon memory driver will simply shrink back down, releasing memory back to the OS, and then SQL Server can simply consume that memory again as it normally would, as it would increase the amount of memory that it wants to use. Now, along with this setting, I've just got one bullet point in here. There's the lock pages and memory setting. It's available in Standard Edition of SQL Server 2008 and Enterprise Edition of all versions of SQL Server since 2000, I believe. So I recommend leaving lock pages and memory disabled unless you've got a real specific reason to enable it, like you found a bug that's causing memory to be paged out, or you've got something on your box that's causing memory to be paged out. And the reason here is that I don't want to see SQL Server, holding on to the memory and causing any sorts of, problems of getting into any sort of page file. If it's enabled, it's definitely going to ignore requests to go to page within the Windows OS. But we don't want to get confused by the fact that it's going to be ignored by the host operating system. So that's one of the reasons I recommend just disabling it most of the time. That, and for the most part, it's not going to be doing anything real beneficial in most circumstances. And again, unless you've found very specific reasons to have it turned on. So along with all these potential memory problems, question. Lock pages in memory? It depends. So if your SQL Server has administrative rights, it is enabled by default. If your SQL Server service account does not have administrative rights, it is disabled by default, unless it's been specifically granted that right within the operating system. Yes? Does the balloon memory driver work at the guest level and the host level? So the balloon memory driver only runs within the guest. Yeah, and it receives calls from the host to do its work. So within the host configuration of the virtual machines, there's a couple of memory settings, or there's a memory setting you can use to help alleviate a lot of potential paging problems and a lot of potential ballooning problems that may happen. And these are called memory reservations. So what these reservations are going to do is it's basically going to tell the host operating system that at a minimum, I want X amount of memory for my virtual machine. So if I've got a VM configured with 64 gigs of RAM, because that's how much memory I want the machine to have under normal operations, normal circumstances, but I want to guarantee that if the balloon memory driver kicks in and that we start taking memory from the host, that I'm never going to take more than, say, 20-some-odd gigs away from the machine, what I'll do is I'll configure a memory reservation on that guest of, say, 36 gigs of RAM. That leaves about 32 gigs for Windows, or for SQL Server, rather, and about 4 gigs for Windows and anything else that's running on the box. So I can set this memory reservation so that when the balloon driver starts to run, I know that it's only going to take so much away from the host before anything, and then it's just going to simply stop because there's going to be nothing else it can take because I've got this reservation set up. And this way I can play nice in the environment. I can give memory back when there's a problem, but I know that I'm going to keep some sort of memory level that I can work with. And so how you pick this memory or this number that you want to use is basically how much memory do you need to keep the application running? Not running well, just running. Because we just need to keep the thing up and running while we're getting through whatever little disaster it is that we've run into. Host being down, some backup operation going nuts on the host, something along those lines that's going to be causing us these weird performance problems. So maybe if I can get away with 32 gigs, maybe we'll set, don't forget to add a couple extra gigs for the host in there. But you need to leave some room in there for the operating system to work with, so you've got can guarantee that amount of memory to the guest operating system. Click. There we go. So within both Hyper-V and VMware, we have some memory deduplication options available to us. So these were introduced in Hyper-V in Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1 at the host level. VMware's had this introduced since, I believe, the 3.0 or 3.5 version of the product. So what these options are doing for us is it's giving the host the ability to basically deduplicate any memory that's been allocated to virtual machines. So this doesn't work all that well for SQL Server, but it works really, really well for guest operating systems. If you think about this, we've got, say, 20 VMs all running on one really big host. Each of those 20 VMs, all running, hopefully, Windows Server 2008 R2, all 20 of those machines taking up about 4 to 6 gigs of memory each at the host level. Now, if we leave the memory deduplication turned on, what we'll see is we'll actually see that 80 or so gigs of memory slowly get whittled down to a much smaller number, probably somewhere around 6, 8, 10 gigs of memory being used. And it's doing this by looking at the signatures, found at the end of the stage. It's doing this by looking at the signatures of the pages in memory and comparing them to each other and finding all the duplicates and discarding the duplicate values and just putting pointers in to all these memory blocks. And it'll do this for the read-only memory. And if memory just changed from read-only to read-write, it'll then simply duplicate that page and let the virtual machine that needs it work with that piece of memory that it's going to be working with. So, like I said, this is great for the operating system because we can get a lot more memory out of our physical boxes than we think we actually have. And this will give us a lot of benefit when it comes to, disaster scenarios where we suddenly need a lot more memory and we can get that additional memory up and running. Now, I mentioned it doesn't work all that great for SQL Server because SQL Server's buffer pools for every one of our SQL Server instances are going to be different because we've obviously got different data stored in each one of these systems. So we need to keep in mind that while we may have this big 64 gig VM, or we may have a few of them all running SQL Server, we're not going to be deduplicating a very large percentage of that VM. It does not take very much CPU power at the host level to actually do this memory deduplication. So I do recommend usually my clients leave this turned on because the bit of benefit you will get out of it is usually outweighed by that small CPU hit that you might take. Yes, sir. So the question was, if you did happen to have multiple SQL servers all with the same data in buffer pool, would this work for it? And yes, it would, assuming that those pages were the same pages. It does require things like database IDs and object IDs to all be the same, because that information is all the same up in the page header. But that should all deduplicate if you do have that same information in all the buffer pool, like if you've got dev QA stage or something like that. Yes, sir. So the question is, how does vMotion affect this? So when a box is vMotioned or live migrated from one server to another, I assume you're in a VMware environment, then the memory blocks will simply be copied over as full memory blocks to the other side, to the new host, and then the new host would then deduplicate them on its side when it got around to it. The memory for that guest would be blown back up to full size as its deltas are copied over. So when working with your storage configurations, or your storage options, or your storage within a virtual machine, we need to pay very close attention to how we're configuring the storage. Storage is one place where it's really easy to get ourselves hurt really, really badly from a performance perspective, because we think we can virtualize all these pieces of the environment, and unfortunately, we really can't. Storage is one of those things where, you know, if I need, you know, 20,000 I/O per hour, I need 20,000 I/O per hour. There's just no getting around that. You know, if I need 5,000 I/O a second, I need 5,000 I/O a second. You know, there's no way really around that very much, because you know it's raw data sitting on the disk that I need to get up into the buffer pool. You know, the only way around that really is to simply add more memory and increase the footprint of my virtual machine. Whenever people tell me they're looking to virtualize a machine, one of the questions that gets asked occasionally is, well, how much can I reduce my I/O footprint or my I/O requirements when I move into a virtual machine? And the answer there is none. You can't remove any of your I/O requirement because it is going to be exactly the same. So you need to keep that in mind when you do think about virtualizing a SQL Server. Now, that said, there are a couple of different ways that you can present storage to your virtual machine. The default is to use virtual disks, either called virtual disks in the Hyper-V environment or called VMDKs in the VMware environment. And those are both going to work basically the same. They each have slightly different proprietary formats to them. So this is the default option. So these virtual disks or VMDKs, these are simply just files sitting on the host operating system's hard drive. So they could be sitting on a LUN stored out on the storage array. They could be sitting on local disks sitting on the server. From the guest perspective, you really don't know where they are because you don't really have any visibility into that from the guest operating system. So if those shared LUNs, because those are going to be shared LUNs at that point because you're going to end up with multiple VMDKs or virtual disks on a single LUN, aren't working for you, there's a few ways you can help get around some of these performance problems. The first would be present a new LUN to the host and simply move the virtual disk for your virtual machine to that new LUN. Hopefully that new LUN is on faster storage or maybe if you've got write performance problems, maybe it's RAID 10 or the old LUN was RAID 5 or something like that. And then that may simply alleviate your problem. Now the nice thing is that migration can be done live, so there's no downtime involved with either the host or the guest operating system. We simply present a LUN to the guest operating or to the host operating system rather. Attach it, format it, add it into the cluster, either through failover cluster administrator if you're in a Hyper-V environment or the vCenter management tool if you're in a VMware environment. And so format it, bring it in, and then literally it's just a matter of right-clicking on the VM and going to migrate and telling it, hey, I want to move the storage, and here's where I want to move it to, and clicking next, 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 finish, and moving the virtual disk to whatever the new location is. Now, in Hyper-V, unfortunately, it's not quite that easy. That'll be coming in version 3, so that'll only work in a VMware environment today. But you can then move that live into a new location. So the question was, in the vCenter configuration tool, can you see the type of storage you're sitting on? To some extent. You will be able to see if it's flash or if it's not flash, or if it'll list SSD or non-SSD. It's not going to tell you the actual RAID type because it doesn't know. Now, if you're in an EMC environment, and they'll be more than happy to show this to you at the EMC booth downstairs, they actually have plugins specifically written for EMC so that the VMware environment can go talk to the EMC array and get more information about that storage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've probably got one of these plugins installed. So his statement was he's seen these additional bits of information where he's seen SATA disks listed where his agreement was that he was supposed to be on Fiber Channel or 15K disks. So you can see some of that information. It all depends on what your storage array is and how much integration they have with the VMware tool and whatnot. So some of that is available to you. So if you're... if you've tried moving to your own dedicated LUN with a virtual disk on it, maybe that's not enough for you. Maybe the little bit of I/O lag time that the hypervisor is putting in place as it's doing all these address translations is simply too much for you. You know, it's slowing things down just a little too much. Another option available to you is to use iSCSI to present storage directly from the guest operating system to the storage array, or rather from the storage array to the guest operating system. So what this does is basically you want to add another virtual NIC to your guest operating system and configure that virtual NIC to talk to the iSCSI targets out on your storage array. This will then let your storage array be allowed, you will now be able to provision storage directly to your guest operating system as if it was just a physical box. So we've now taken the storage layer of the hypervisor out of the equation here, and we are now putting, unfortunately, a little more load on the network piece of the hypervisor. Now, if you're working in a Windows Hyper-V environment, and you want to build a Windows cluster with two guest operating systems, iSCSI is your only option. So you will have to use iSCSI if you do want to do that. Just FYI for you there. So, question in the back. Sorry, can't hear you. Yell louder. Use a microphone.
My understanding is that they actually will support Fibre Channel starting 2012, right?
I believe that's correct. I've heard the same thing. I believe it requires using the storage spaces. So I believe that will work. That will work in the Hyper-V V3 under 2012. So unfortunately, I'm not an expert on Hyper-V V3. I've been on the road for the last 6 weeks, so I haven't been able to play with the new release that dropped, 2 weeks ago or something. But I do believe Fibre Channel will be supported for guest clustering at that point. So your third option today, if the iSCSI isn't working or if you don't have iSCSI as an option for you, is to use what's called either a pass-through disk if you're in a Hyper-V environment or a raw device mapping if you're in a VMware environment. And what we're doing in this particular case is we're mounting new LUNs to the host operating system, but we're not formatting or configuring those LUNs really at the host level. What we're doing is we're actually giving the guest full control of those LUNs within at the guest level. So the guest is what's actually going to format those LUNs, and the guest is going to lay its file system on those LUNs directly without having any involvement of the host operating system really. So you can actually see this by taking the LUN away from the host operating system once the guest has formatted it and actually presenting it to a physical box, and you'll actually be able to read the volume on that physical box. It'll mount just like normal, and you'll be able to access it just like normal because it is just a Windows LUN at that point. So that'll give you an additional configuration option, and what we're doing at that point is basically just giving our guest SQL Server direct access to the Fibre Channel storage array, assuming we're in a Fibre Channel environment. So another option there to give you some additional performance on your disk access. So if you're in a storage array that supports any sort of auto-tiering, this can be a great performance benefit to you because you can get access to Fibre Channel, or flash drives rather, without having to move your entire database onto a flash drive-based LUN or flash-based LUN. So the way these work is we take various kinds of disks, flash, Fibre Channel, and SATA, and we'll put them all into one big pool within the storage array. We then tell the storage array to create the LUN in this pool and spread it across these types of disks as best it can. So what the storage array will then do is it'll monitor the performance or the access requirements of each little piece of this LUN. And the size of those pieces is going to vary from vendor to vendor. Usually they're somewhere between 128 megs and 1 gig, kind of depending on who your manufacturer or your storage array is. And so it's going to measure the access done to each one of these little slices. And as the access to each one of these slices increases, it's going to move it to faster and faster storage. So whatever pieces of your database are getting updated the most or getting hit the most are going to end up moving up to the flash drives. Well, all the rest of the data is going to stay down on the less expensive and slower Fibre Channel and SATA drives. So this can give you a real performance boost without spending a whole heck of a lot of money, because you only need a few flash drives to really make this effective, instead of having to buy huge amounts of flash drives so you can put your entire database on flash, when maybe you only actually need to put maybe 10% or 5% of your database on flash, or, you know, just depending on how big your database is and how much of it you actually use on a regular basis. So these auto-tiering technologies are great for your data files and your indexes and your tempdb, sort of for your tempdb. Your transaction logs are going to be basically worthless if you put them into this auto-configuration environment. And the reason for that is transaction logs are circular. So by the time we've accessed the disk enough times to force it to be moved up to a faster tier of storage, we're not accessing that piece of the disk anymore, that piece of the file anymore. We've now moved on to another piece. So I would actually recommend putting your transaction logs all on traditional RAID 10 storage for best performance, simply, again, because of the way the transaction log works. Tempdb as well can not get the most benefit out of things like the auto-tiering storage, because the pages that we're accessing within the tempdb file are going to be very sporadic and very all over the place. In some configurations, it may work fine to go ahead and put those onto this auto-tiering environment or onto flash. In some environments, it might not make any sense because of the way the data is being written into the table or into the data files. So you're going to really need to look at the actual data and really dig into the data files as to what objects are making up which pages, or made up by which pages, to figure out if it's going to make sense and you're going to hit the same pages over and over and over again enough to move them into some sort of auto-tiering environment, if it's going to be worth it, or if you're just going to be moving data into flash and then it's going to sit there, age out, and move back down, and you're just going to end up moving data back and forth for really no reason whatsoever and giving yourself no benefit there. Yes, sir. The question was, for tempdb, do I tend to put both drives on the same disk or do I put them on different disks? In a perfect world, I'd put them on separate drives. For tempdb, it sometimes doesn't matter. It really depends on what you're using tempdb for, because not all operations in tempdb are going to be logged, or maybe they're going to be minimally logged. It's just page allocations are being logged and that's it. So it's really going to depend on how we're using tempdb as to whether or not you're going to see enough benefit by moving the log to another disk to make it worth your while. So unfortunately, I can't give really a more solid answer than that. I wish I could. So for the last bullet point up there, even though we're in a virtual environment and we don't know really what the underlying physical environment is necessarily, I do always still recommend we keep our OS data logs and tempdb on separate volumes within Windows. Yes, sir? So the question was, what about the swap file for the operating system? I usually put that where the OS is. You're talking about the Windows page file? Okay, so yeah, I typically leave the Windows page file on the C drive because I don't put anything else on the C drive. So I'll leave it there for a couple of reasons. One, it's the default configuration, so it's easy. Two, if I want to be able to do a dump file, I need the page file to be on C. So unless I need a very, very large page file, which normally you wouldn't in a SQL Server environment, I've got servers with half a terabyte of RAM or quarter terabyte of RAM where I've got a four gig page file. So you don't necessarily need a large page file for those boxes, so it'll fit on the C drive nicely. And the third thing is, the C drive isn't going to be doing a whole lot else, so you can really leave the page file there. It should be just fine. Now, there are some circumstances where I have moved it to a separate drive, and those are usually a case where I'm doing storage-level replication of my virtual machines off to another site. So what I'll do is I'll put the page file onto its own hard drive, like an R drive or a P drive or something like that, so that I don't replicate that LUN that the page files are being written to, so that I can reduce the amount of traffic that I'm sending over to my remote site. Different options. One second, I'll grab you. Different options available, kind of depending on how I want to configure things and what I'm doing with the LUNs. But for the most part, most of my clients aren't replicating the guest OSs, to another site, so I end up just leaving the page file on C. But if you are seeing performance problems with that, you know, there are valid reasons to try moving it to another drive. Yes, sir. So the question was, so you know, what benefit is there to with formatting the disk with 64K block sizes? So SQL Server does all its data file access in 64K chunks. So all its reads and writes are going to be done in 64K chunks. So if you're formatting the blocks of the data volumes at 64K, that is the same size that SQL Server is going to be looking for. So you'll be minimizing the amount of physical operations that need to be sent down the pipe to actually get those blocks back. And to make those data changes. So that should give you the best performance possible by doing those 64K blocks. Now, along with that, if you're virtualizing older operating systems, so if you're virtualizing Windows 2003 or, God help you, Windows 2000 servers, those machines you need to be very careful when you virtualize because you need to make sure that those disks are properly aligned when they're moved into your virtual environment. If you thought that misaligned disks were going to cause you performance problems in the physical world, try having 30 or 40 disks all misaligned, all sitting on the same LUN, all doing data updates and data changes, doing twice as much I/O as they actually need to. So you get massive, massive performance bottlenecks there. So fixing those misalignment problems is definitely a big, 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 big thing to make sure you do in your virtual environments. Yes, sir. So the question was, can you have starting offset alignment problems with VMDKs? Absolutely. If your host LUNs are aligned correctly, but your guest OSs aren't, you know, they will end up being misaligned.
Both have to be aligned.
Yeah, both do have to be aligned. So the upside, Hyper-V was introduced with Windows Server 2008. So Hyper-V fixes it automatically when you create the LUNs because it does do the alignment offset at 1 meg. And obviously, any multiple of 64K that you do the alignment at will work fine, 1 meg being a multiple of 64K. In the VMware environment, if your VMware team is creating the LUNs in the GUI, in the vCenter management GUI, then they're going to be correctly aligned. If your VMware admins are trying to be smarter than the GUI and creating them manually through FDisk in the host operating system, then they may not be correctly aligning them because they would have to do it manually at that point. So as long as they're creating the storage groups and formatting the LUNs within the GUI, then everything will be getting created just fine and exactly how you would expect it to get created in that virtual environment. So the last topic I want to talk about is storage deduplication. So this is a concept being introduced by more and more storage array vendors today to help save not only space, but improve performance. And this really, really helps in virtual environments, especially with host operating systems, but even with SQL Server database files. So what we do with this storage level deduplication is, you know, we're all familiar with deduplicating memory now, because we talked about that about half an hour ago. So we do kind of the same thing here at the storage level. As the data is being written to the storage array, the storage array is simply looking for duplicate blocks or duplicate pages that are being written into the array, and it's simply getting rid of those duplicate values. So with the guest operating systems, that obviously is fairly easy for the storage array to do. When you're deploying guests within your environment, you're probably doing this based off a template. So you're just taking taking a file and just copying it over and over and over again, making a few little changes along the way as you change computer name, and you change network IP addresses and a few various registry settings. But for the most part, the operating system is going to be exactly the same. So it'll dedupe really, really easily. I had one environment where I had deployed 90-some-odd virtual machines on a single LUN. The virtual machines were, I think, 11 gigs each. I was only actually using 63 gigs of storage on my storage array because the rest of that data had simply been deduplicated away. So this gives me a few benefits. The first being that I don't need to read this data off the disk over and over and over again. Because the first time one of the VMs boots, it loads all its data off the disk and runs it through the cache. Well, if I boot 5 VMs all at once, they're all going to access basically the same information in about the same amount of time. So the first one's going to go request the data from the disk, and it's going to load the data into the storage array's cache, which is kind of like its version of buffer pool. And then that data is going to get sent up to the virtual machine, and so the virtual machine can boot. Well, when the next VM goes to access those same physical blocks, those blocks are already in cache at this point. So it can just request them back from the cache, and or pass, the storage array will pass them out of its cache, and the virtual machine will simply be able to boot off them and start reading those pages. So all this can happen very, very quickly in a very, very small amount of cache, because we don't need to be reading all this data over and over and over again as we're booting up all these machines. Now, SQL Server database files, one would think, wouldn't deduplicate all that well. But actually, I was very surprised to find out when I was doing this that they actually did. I was actually able to get about 2.4 to 1 deduplication or space savings when I was setting up this deduplication for a production SQL Server environment. And this was not, you know, a data warehouse with lots of duplicate data and data spread out all over the place. This is actually encrypted medical data. So this is actually the worst possible case for the storage array to try to deduplicate. And it was actually able to do a decent job of deduplicating the data and give me a decent amount of space savings as I was going through this process of getting the system up and running. And I was honestly surprised by that. Yes, sir? So his question was this using a VMDK or was this using some sort of raw device or pass-through disk? So in this case, I was using a VMDK. So it was just virtual disk created, you know, presented. Oh, wait, was it? No, sorry. The OSs were VMDKs. This was a raw device mapping for the data files in this particular case. Sorry, my mistake. So the SQL Server just was writing native Windows data down to the disk. But I was able to get a decent amount of performance boost out of that by deduplicating that data. Yes? So the question was, it shouldn't make any difference if it's a raw device or a VMDK since we're just deduping data at that point. It shouldn't, because as I understand the layouts of the virtual disks and the VMDKs, all there is basically some header information, and then at that point the data just basically gets written down as you would normally expect it to be. So it should just be raw data at that point. So I wouldn't think there would be, and I didn't see any problems doing it with VMDKs or raw devices. I was just presenting, you know, 1 terabyte LUNs, so I didn't want to create big 1 terabyte VMDKs when I was doing this. It was easier to use RDMs in this particular instance. So obviously we get a bunch of performance benefits. Like I think I mentioned some of this earlier, when we are using storage deduplication, the first piece being we're reading the data up off the disk and into the cache only once, so we don't have to read that same data over and over and over again. And then there's also, obviously, the space savings. So if we're saving a lot of space, we're not using the spindles as much because we just don't need to go hit those spindles quite as often. And when we do need to hit those spindles, those blocks that we're looking for are probably going to be closer together. So those spindles are going to be able to respond faster because, obviously, that's the thing that makes spindles respond the slowest is when they are trying to do multiple things and they are trying to spin the heads into various different positions to try to get access to the data that we need to get access to. So I snuck an extra slide in here that wasn't in here because I know everybody loves talking about monitoring. So monitoring is obviously extremely important when looking at performance problems in your virtual environment. You need to remember you've got those monitoring tools that are available to you. You've got the vCenter management tool that's going to have your information, and you've got your information being captured by SCOM in the Hyper-V space. Now, don't just monitor these systems in the abstract and just go look at them whenever there's a problem. You need to be baselining this information and make sure that you know what normal performance looks like. Because monitoring is great, for when there's problems, but you need to know what normal looks like, because how do I know if there's a problem otherwise? If all I'm doing is looking at systems and in the abstract, when there's a problem going, oh, well, disk is high, disk IO is high, Well, how do I know that's an issue? If I don't have my historical data, if I don't know what my baseline is for that system, and take those baselines over time to see, you know, where everything is going. When you're working in a virtual environment, there's lots of moving pieces that you need to keep an eye on. First thing, obviously, you need to be monitoring within SQL Server to see what it's doing. You need to look at what it thinks the disk is doing, what it thinks the CPU numbers are looking like, you know, what everything it's trying to do, what are its weights looking like, because obviously that's what SQL Server is going to be reporting, is what it sees. So you need to monitor at the SQL Server level. You also need to monitor at the guest level. Make sure that you've got these numbers coming in from the guest operating system so you can see what Windows thinks is going on, what our guest operating system thinks is going on. Because if we don't know what our guest OS thinks is happening, we can't correlate that to the host operating system and see what's going on there, either the hypervisor or the host, however you need to get access to that information. Because we need to be able to go, okay, I can see, you know, my CPU load in my guest. I can see it's X percentage of CPU. You know, so why am I getting these performance problems? Why, when I remote desktop into the server, does it take 5 minutes for Management Studio to load, other than the fact that it's Management Studio and it's really slow? You know, why does it take forever for these things to boot and for things to redraw on the screen when my guest OS says that, you know, my performance or my CPU is running at 4%? You know, when I go look at the host OS, though, well, the host is at 98%. No wonder we're having performance problems. We need to do some live migrations or some vMotions and get some guests moved off of that host, try to free up some resources and get things back down to where they need to be. This is one of the reasons that I actually still advocate doing Windows clustering at the guest level, is because it makes it a lot easier for me to move things around from one host to another if I've got two guest operating systems that I can work with. Because I'm going to obviously configure the host operating system to keep those guests in two different places. And when I do that, you know, once I've done that, I've now got these sitting on different boxes. So if the one running my SQL Server is having problems, you know what, I'm going to take that outage hit and I'm going to fail that Windows cluster over to another, to the guest running on another host. I'm assuming you have a question in the back, sir.
Can you talk about file groups and partitioning in a virtual environment? What are the advantages and when do you get them?
So this question is, what are the benefits of using table partitioning in a virtual environment? And, you know, when would I want to use this, when would I didn't, and, you know, how would the benefits be, you know, how would they look here? So you get the same sort of performance benefits that you would get in the physical world, if you're using a physical SQL Server doing table partitioning. I'm assuming you're talking about trying to put expensive current data on flash drives, older data on slower drives, older data on slower drives. You would get the same level of performance benefit out of doing that in a virtual environment because SQL Server is going to be accessing data, you know, only the data it needs, because it's only going to be hitting that one partition, that one disk. So you should see the same benefits. You shouldn't see really any differences if moving from a virtual machine into a physical machine into a virtual machine. So along with monitoring the hypervisor and the host, monitor that storage array as well, because you need to know what the storage array is doing to make sure that it's getting that response time that you think it is. You know, think back to that story that I told you at the beginning of the session, where I was at that managed service provider and, you know, my LUN had been extended onto some other file group or some other RAID group rather, and, you know, my performance just went absolutely berserk and I had no idea why. If you're not monitoring the storage array, you're never going to see these sorts of problems creep up. Storage arrays, unfortunately, they don't all give you monitoring software for free. This is where I get to poke fun at the EMC guys for a minute, because they charge an arm and a leg for their monitoring tool. However, their monitoring tool is worth every penny of it, because as soon as you've solved a single performance problem using it, you've just justified the cost of buying it, because there's no other way to get access to that information without using their monitoring tool, because there is no open-ended, you know, available tool you can buy that will just monitor the storage array. You have to use their infrastructure to do that. And so the only way to do that is to buy their tool. But again, worth every single penny, because I've saved clients huge amounts of money just by using those monitoring tools that I've had to convince them to purchase. And then suddenly they become very worth it when we are able to resolve some sort of problem, with those monitoring tools, you know, in a fairly quick and easy way. So some additional sessions for you. I don't unfortunately know which of these sessions have already happened and which ones haven't. So the product demonstrations that I'll be at will be down at the SQL Server booth. So if you get down into the exhibit hall, you'll back to the back. It's the big gray sign in the back. It's not my fault they picked gray as the color. But I'll be at one of those demonstrations tomorrow morning from 10:30 to 12 or 12:30, I believe. If you are interested in certification, obviously the MCSE SQL Server 2012 certification is going to be the one you're looking for. That should be coming out in just a few months. I know the beta process happened a couple months ago, so we should be getting that released to the general availability relatively quickly. Apparently, this was supposed to be filled up by my track lead, and he didn't get around to filling it out. Please do check out the SQL Server 2012 eval copies that you can get online. You can download that from Microsoft.com/SQL. We've got some hands-on labs being run, I believe, by Brent Ozar through the course of tomorrow. Today is Wednesday, right? Yeah, so tomorrow during Thursday. It's been a great week, but it's been a long week. And we've got a couple of SQL Server and Microsoft Tech Ed Twitter accounts you can follow if you're on Twitter. Get lots of great information about Twitter. I see somebody taking a picture, so I'll leave this up for a second. Got your picture? Okay. Do complete an eval. If you don't know how to complete an eval, basically just go to northamerica.msteched.com, log into your MyTechEd to the schedule builder, and you should see the evaluate link down there at the bottom. I know it's a pain to fill out evals. They are only 5 or 6 questions, though, just a couple of radio buttons and a comment box at the bottom. The evals are extremely useful for all the presenters. This is how we as presenters get better and how we decide which presentations we're going to submit for next year. And more importantly for TechEd, it's how they figure out if they want to have us back, as if you guys liked the presentations and liked the presenters that you saw. So if you liked the presentation, and I hope you did, since you're still sitting here, go ahead and please do fill out the evals so we can get those eval scores in. There are some great prizes, including one of those nice pretty Xboxes if you don't have one of those yet. As well as Best Buy gift cards and a whole bunch of other good stuff that they'll get for you. So Microsoft is kind enough to put these tags in the slide deck, so you can go ahead and take a picture of that if you want to do your eval right now. That'll kick you over to the MyTechEd site on your phone. I'll come back to that in a second, because that is the end of the deck. So I thank you all very much for coming. I've got business cards up here if you'd like one. If you've got questions, feel free to come on up. I would be more than happy to answer them. Thank you all very much.